Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Earlier this summer, the University of New Hampshire was caught off guard when the online publication campusreform.org published excerpts from a bias-free language guide posted on the UNH website. The preferred language guide stated, among other things, that the adjective American is outdated and problematic, and that U.S. citizen, resident of the U.S., or North American should be used instead. UNH President Mark Huddleston condemned the guide and released a statement saying that it did not reflect university policy and, quote, "It is ironic that what was probably a well-meaning effort to be sensitive proves offensive to many people, myself included." That level of sensitivity to words and ideas is why comedians Chris Rock and Jerry Seinfeld say they no longer perform on college campuses. In a cover story for The Atlantic magazine called The Coddling of the American Mind, Greg Lukianoff and Jonathan Haidt propose that it is not only disastrous for education, but for mental health. And Greg Lukianoff is with us. Thank you for joining us for On Word of Mouth.
Thanks so much for having me.
So how does that story of the preferred language guide illustrate the coddling that you write about?
Well, it's part of a larger trend of language policing that's been going on campuses for decades. It just seems to have gotten, and I'm a First Amendment lawyer, that's my background, and I've been defending free speech rights on college campuses ever since I got out of law school back in 2001. But something's gotten more intense in the past 2 years, and the level of language policing has stepped up, and to a large degree, it seems to be coming from students. Now, University of New Hampshire is a particularly interesting case because while they focused a lot on calling someone American might be problematic or a microaggression, there were so many other things that I found fascinating about it, not the least of which is they said that the word Arab could be found problematic and offensive, which sounded like something right out of a parody. It's like you're actually saying that where someone's from is actually offensive just right off the bat. That's crazy.
Who creates those kind of policies?
Sometimes it's administrators. Sometimes it's the students themselves, like at Ithaca College, where they created a microaggressions reporting system, which, it's supposed to actually help students talk across lines of difference. But it includes, reporting. It includes keeping track of the demographics of both the microaggressor and the microaggressed against. And I made a point in the Huffington Post. It's like, if you actually think this is going to make people more comfortable to engage in candor across lines of difference, I think you're kidding yourselves.
What are microaggressions exactly?
Microaggressions are unconscious slights, and the term was coined in the 1970s by a professor who was interested in unconscious racist slights. So, for example, like someone who meets someone who's African American, and they really emphasize, "My, aren't you articulate?" Now, that's obnoxious, and those kind of slights are very interesting to study. But when people start policing them in a way that actually causes everyone to watch every word they say, you end up interfering with candor, you end up interfering with free speech. And it's one of those things that I talk about. If we really want people to get to know each other, we really want to bridge boundaries, the kind of safe spaces we should be creating are spaces where it's safe to be wrong.
The culture that you say is being created, you call vindictive protectiveness. What does that mean?
That's the edge that we've seen in the last couple of years. And what we mean by that is, in an effort to protect victim groups usually, there's been a lot more language policing in the form of microaggressions policing, in the form of speech codes, in the form of demanding apologies or people be fired. And what's interesting is when I watch this time and time again, it's not usually coming from the people who are themselves the supposed victim group. It's coming from people who have sort of taken on the cause of protecting them. And to me, it always has a little bit of a Victorian, a little bit of a patronizing element to it. But it has gotten particularly sharp in the past year.
You're talking about the last couple of years. Can you kind of trace a starting point for when this started playing out on campuses across the country?
I definitely noticed an uptick right around the time at Brown University. Ray Kelly was supposed to speak there. And Ray Kelly is the person who's responsible for the stop and frisk program in New York. But what had happened at his Brown speech is student protests, which were originally focusing on getting him disinvited, actually got him to concede to do an extensive question and answer period where you know, if you really wanted to ask Ray Kelly a hard question, he was giving you the opportunity to. So for us free speech people, us academic freedom people, this was great. But instead what happened after this concession, students nonetheless showed up and shouted so loud for half an hour that they just called off the speech, which of course was the most frustrating to the activists who really wanted to ask Ray Kelly some hard questions. And it seemed like something that seemed to be almost, I'm not sure if it was a turning point or if just noticing it more, whereas generally a lot of what we fought on campuses were administrators who were out of control, who were just sort of throwing their weight around. It's been, as I said, coming more from students lately.
Well, you and your co-author identify a number of new practices and pieces of language making their way into college lectures and discourse. You mentioned microaggressions, vindictive protectiveness. But trigger warnings, what are they? And give us some cases where they've come up.
Trigger warnings, you know, they started in a very well-intended way, and as best we can tell, they started mostly in the on campuses, and then moved to the feminist blogosphere, and primarily dealing with people discussing sexual assault, and what they would and there'd be whole forums devoted to talking about sexual assault, and someone would put in front of that trigger warning where I'm about to discuss in graphic detail what happened to me, and that's very much understandable. They managed to start popping up on college campuses in the past 2 years. And again, I think they're generally well-intentioned. But, you know, I'll give some examples of things that I've heard from professors students have demanded trigger warnings for. Probably the most ridiculous one I've heard was a social psychology professor told being chastised by a student for not providing a trigger warning before a discussion of Pavlov's dog because the Pavlov's dog story involved animal cruelty. And this is... And I understand why professors are worried about that. Now, to explain, some professors think these are great and think that they're not a problem at all. My concern as a First Amendment person is if you create an expectation that it's up to the professor to anticipate everything that a student might find upsetting and warn them in advance, you're putting them in an impossible situation. And that's exactly what seven humanities professors wrote to Inside Higher Education last year.
The offense is all in the judgment of the person who is being triggered. And this is part of your big argument here, that advocating for trigger warnings policies to protect emotional well-being and zero tolerance for microaggressions actually harm students psychologically. How?
The primary way it works is just by looking at your own automatic thoughts and asking yourself, is this reasonable? Is this fair? Am I arguing fairly with myself? Or am I exaggerating what's going on? Am I, for example, engaged in dichotomous thinking? Am I thinking that if I don't do well at this interview, my life is over, or if this person breaks up with me, that's it for me? That's a classic cognitive distortion. And in my experience on campus, what I've seen is, what I believe is, a lot of teaching students through example, primarily from administrators, thinking that something relatively small that's happened means it's going to be a catastrophe, is a behavior I think that gets modeled for students from K through 12 all the way up through college. And I think that this sort of overprotectiveness that we've hoisted upon students is resulting in students who actually believe that they're much more fragile than they are. And this can actually be a self-fulfilling prophecy.
I'm talking with Greg Lukianoff of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. He's also co-author of an article for The Atlantic called The Coddling of the American Mind, which criticizes the tiptoeing or avoiding literature, perspectives, and ideas that college students might find upsetting. Their conclusion, it's not only bad for education, but for mental health and development. Well, it is easy to say students who are rallying against the offensive speech are being oversensitive. But isn't this how many social shifts have happened historically? You know, people saying it is not okay to call that man AX or that woman X. You know what I mean? That not letting those things slide.
Absolutely. I agree that a lot of what is sort of roughly called political correctness is sort of an overcorrection that ends up sometimes being taken too far.
I'm thinking of the New York Times depiction of the corporate culture at Amazon. Did you read that article or hear about it?
I haven't read. I heard a lot about it, though.
Well, it's predominantly male leadership and similarly Silicon Valley bro culture. I mean, a lot of it is really offensive. So I guess that's the question. I mean, you're a First Amendment lawyer. Where do you draw the line between what is and what isn't offensive?
well, what is and what isn't offensive? I mean, First Amendment lawyers don't so much draw the line between what is and what isn't offensive. We draw the line between what is and what isn't protected. So I'm sort of wearing a different hat for this article. But as a First Amendment lawyer, I don't think people should be, you know, going to jail for being offensive. I don't think it should be a crime to be offensive. I think that would be a terrible idea. But I do think that, you know, calling people out when they've been when they're being offensive or being insensitive is the right way to handle these issues. But I do at the same time, as I wrote in my book, Freedom from Speech, I think that we've been not even hearing each other out at all lately as a society and to a degree on campus. So I advocate, you know, some of these very old-fashioned ideas, like try to hear what someone's saying first before you assume that they shouldn't have said it in the first place.
Hmm. Well, your organization has defended students and faculty who oppose or have been who have lost or left jobs, academic jobs, or been written up for offenses.
Yep.
In your conversations with them, how has this sensitivity changed academia?
Well, it's been interesting because, you know, for a long time, we've defended professors for our entire history. We defended students for our entire history. But in the past couple of years, particularly when I'm doing radio shows, I've had a lot more professors calling in saying they're freaked out, that essentially they're afraid that it's just way too easy to say the wrong thing. It doesn't. And then this is part of the problem is we don't count someone's intention at all anymore. Like if you say something that offends a student, it's all entirely on you. And that's a very hard environment in which to teach serious things. So I thought Jeannie Sook's article, she's a Harvard Law professor in the New Yorker this year, where she talked about how increasingly students are requesting that professors not teach law related to sexual assault in law school, and how troubling that is, because in the attempt to sort of avoid radioactive or difficult topics, we're engaged in a behavior that actually would, of course, most hurt victims of sexual assault who might need a lawyer who knows a little bit about the law around it. So I do think that in some cases, taken too far, this language policing is preventing conversations we desperately need to have.
So what is the solution? I mean, you're talking about undoing decades of protective parenting and movements for complete inclusiveness.
Well, you know, we're trying to offer a solution in our article, which is I think people should learn a little bit more about cognitive behavioral therapy and cognitive distortions, in part because I think they're just in general good rules for how to argue productively. I think we should be teaching people debate and discussion. I think we should be teaching people how to civilly disagree, how to actually have a meaty discussion. And I think universities should be inculcating this. So, you know, as a free speech advocate, I was one of the biggest boosters of Twitter, particularly when it first started, because I felt like it was the closest we've ever seen to sort of the collective unconscious of the entire species. Because when you get to see what people say without thinking about it and say it as quickly as possible in reaction to what they're seeing, you get to see something, some very deep and sometimes not entirely pleasant aspects of human nature, but interesting nonetheless. And I think that there was, you know, for a while there, at least on Twitter, there was an understanding that in 140 characters, you're going to have to give some benefit of the doubt. You're going to have to assume that you don't entirely know what someone meant by that tweet. And somehow it just seems like that's entirely reversed. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, John Ronson's book, you know, So You've Been Publicly Shamed is so terrific, is because it actually checks us for a second to say, wait a second, hold on, we're just dying to shut down debate and discussion. We're just dying to actually find someone to villainize so we can go after them if they say something wrong on Twitter, which is not the way I think we should be thinking about it.
Well, social media, it's quite easy to be indignant on social media, and there are very little consequences in the human scale.
Yeah, Bill Maher wrote a great article in the New York Times several years ago talking about the Let's Not Be Offended Day, calling out what he saw it as feigned offendedness, and just making the point that, yeah, sometimes people are offended. Sometimes people are offended too easily, but sometimes they don't really mean it. Sometimes it's just a sort of pantomime to go after views or people you dislike. And so what I am saying and what Bill Maher was saying is sometimes it's tactical. Sometimes it's insincere and it's used as a weapon in this increasingly sort of polarized political debate that we have. And it's interesting to watch how some of the sharpest criticisms aren't so much across groups. They seem to be increasingly like within, where it's essentially whether it's on the right or the left, that how quickly people accuse someone of not being pure enough or being a traitor in vitriolic language that, again, I believe should be protected. But there are better ways to argue about things than we're currently engaged in.
Okay, so it looks like all those kids whose parents tried to control their environment when they were growing up have successfully controlled their environment, you know, against any kind of potentially offensive language or concepts. So what is getting lost from a college education?
Well, I think we're doing students, to a degree, a great disservice, because the simple fact is that's represented both by cognitive behavioral therapy and the wisdoms of the ancients going back to Marcus Aurelius and the Buddha, is that you cannot control the facts of the world around you. And if you believe you can, you're going to be constantly disappointed. But what you can control is how you think about them. And one of the things that's wonderful about CBT is it empowers students to live in the world as it is, as opposed to flee from it.
Well, Greg, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Greg Lukianoff, he is president and CEO of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. He's co-author of the cover story for The Atlantic magazine. It's called The Coddling of the American Mind. You'll find a link to read the article for yourself at wordofmouthradio.org.